Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So this morning we get reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 10. We'll read texts 24, 25, and 26 is on the board for chanting responsibly. So I'll read the Sanskrit of texts 24 and 25, and then we can proceed to 26. Tato nishkramya lankaya yatu danya sahasrashaha mandodarya samam tatra prarudantya upadravan. Text 25. Svan svan bandun pral parishvajya lakshmane shubir arditan Rarudu Sushvaram Dina Ganantya Atmanam Atmanam. And text 26, which is what we'll chant responsibly. Ha ha tasma vayam nata Loka ravana ravana Kamyaya charnam lanka Tvadvihina parardita Ahata sma vayam tata Nata Loka ravana ravana Hamyaya charanam lanka Tvadvihina parardita Ahatasma vayam nata Loka ravana ravana Kamyaya charanam lanka Tvadvihina paradita. Please chant. Ahatasma vayam nata Loka ravana ravana Kamyaya charanam lanka Tvam vihina paradita. Ahatasma vayam yata Loka ravana ravana Tamyaya charanam lanka Tvadvihina paradita. So I'll read the translation of text 24 and 25 and then 26. So text 24. Thereafter, all the women whose husbands had fallen in the battle headed by Mandodari, the wife of Ravana, came out of Lanka, continuously crying. They approached the dead bodies of Ravana and the other Rakshasas. And text 25. Striking their breasts in affliction because their husbands had been killed by the arrows of Lakshman, the woman embraced their respective husbands and cried piteously in voices appealing to everyone. And in text 26, can do the word for word. Alas, Hataha, killed, Sma, in the past, Vayam, all of us, Nata, O protector, Loka Ravana, O husband who created the crying of so many other people, Ravana, O Ravana, one who can cause crying of others, come unto whom Yayat will go, Sharanam, shelter, Lanka, the state of Lanka, Tvat Vihina, being bereft of your good self, Para Ardita, being defeated by the enemies. And the translation for text 26. O my Lord, O Master, you epitomized trouble for others, and therefore you were called Ravana. But now that you have been defeated, we also are defeated, for without you the state of Lanka has been conquered by the enemy. To whom will it go for shelter? Purport. Ravana's wife, Mandadari, and the other wives knew very well how cruel a person Ravana was. The very word Ravana means one who causes crying for others. Ravana continuously caused trouble for others, but when his sinful activities culminated in giving trouble to Sita Devi, he was killed by Lord Ramachandra. Om Agyana Timurandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Vanchakalpa Taribhyas Chakripa Sindhubhya Vacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Roma Padaswami Iti Namine Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschitya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare so it's a very short purport. and in this particular moment, we have Mandadari, the wife of Ravana, and also the wives of the other Rakshasas, or the man-eaters. They're grieving for the loss of Ravana and their Rakshasa husbands, respectively. And this grief was expressed by the woman as they came out of Lanka in the form of continuous crying and striking of their breasts because of their great distress. The deaths of their husband had come about by the stones and the mountain peaks and the trees that had been hurled at them by the monkey soldiers of Lord Ramachandra. So that was the cause of their death. And this had happened under the command of the various monkey army commanders, and the names of those commanders were Angada, Sugriva Hanuman, Gandhamada, Nila, Jambavan, and Panasha. So these deaths were possible even with the rudimentary weapons, because those soldiers of Ravana, they'd lost their good fortune. And their fortune had been lost because of the curse that Mother Sita had cast upon Ravana. indeed, if we actually look at Valmiki's Ramayana, we see that the curse is expressed to Ravana. He's in the guise of a sannyasi in front of Mother Sita, and her curse comes after Ravana reveals his actual identity. So Ravana's giving trouble to Sita is, you could say, encapsulated in these words that Sita utters. So this is Sita addressing Ravana in the forest. He's in the guise of a sannyasi, and he's just revealed who he is. So she says, so he reveals himself this way. He says, "Sita, I'm the lord of the Rakshasas, the famous ruler of Lanka, the holy terror of all the worlds and the beings therein. Ravana am I named. From the moment I set my eyes upon you in your garment of white silk, which is a poor foil to your complexion of fine molten gold, my heart turns from my wives with disgust. Countless are the ladies, the best of their class, whom I have carried away from the worlds above and below, and I entreat you to be their queen and mistress. Lanka, my capital, is cunningly erected by Maya on Mount Trikuta. Your days shall pass in a dream of bliss along with me on hill slopes, in forests and gardens. Hateful and repulsive will seem to you the life you are leading now. Be my wife, and 5,000, calls him Tire Woman, and maids wait upon you, young, beautiful, and flashing with gold and gems." So this is Ravana in the guise of sannyasi, revealing to Sita who he actually is. And of course, she had seen through his disguise, but out of respect to the sannyas order, she had invited him to sit down for a simple meal from the forest. And this is how what he proposes to her when he reveals who he is. And and it's sort of these words encapsulate the trouble he's giving to Sita. so the trouble naturally is that it's completely inappropriate for him to be uttering such words to a Sita who's married to Lord Ramachandra. So Sita's curse in response takes this form. And she's described as being mad with rage at these words of Ravana. So she casts a glance of withering contempt at the sinful wretch. So these are her words, the curse comes here. Monster of wickedness, who did you take me for that you rave to? My lord and husband is impregnable as Mount Meru, unapproachable as the deep ocean, of matchless valor like Mahendra, and I strive to practice the Dharma he has set himself to. He is crowned with every noble perfection. Like a wide-spreading banyan, he deserves to be the refuge of all beings. Ever loyal to truth, his nobility of heart is something inconceivable, and I humbly follow in his footsteps. With long and powerful arms, a deep, spacious chest, a gait like that of a maddened lion, he's a lion among men. He's endowed with the strength, courage, and daring of a lion, and his face is as charming as a full-orbed moon. Of stern self-control, his fame illuminates the worlds, and him do I humbly seek to imitate. So, Sita's view of Lord Ramachandra paints this picture of Lord Ramachandra as the ideal husband. She's given the physical description and also a description of his character. And she reveals her faithfulness, her chastity, and her gentleness. And we get some idea of the gentleness of Sita and how she rebukes Ravana. So he's just proposed to her that, you know, he's looking at his own wives in disgust and he just simply wants her to be his wife. And so this is how she rebukes him. And it's done in such a gentle way. I mean, I'm going to read it. I have to draw on this. It's a very short purport, so I'm elaborating from the Ramayana. So here's how her rebuke of Ravana. A lion is Ram, and a base jackal you are. The fathomless ocean is Ram, and a dirty rill you are. A sweet and priceless beverage is Ram, and foul-smelling vinegar you are. Molten gold of 1,008 carats is Ram, and base dull lead you are. A delicious sandal paste is Ram, filthy slime mire you are. An elephant in rut is Ram, a puny cat you are. The monarch of all birds, Garuda, is Ram. A thieving crow you are. A peacock of dazzling beautiful feathers is Ram. An ugly waterfowl you are. A lordly swan is Ram. A bald, repulsive vulture you are. What a world of difference between you and him. As well might a gnat swallow a diamond and hope to digest it. Grant that you carry me away. Could you keep me safe while the mighty bow of Ram extends over me the shadow of its protection? And this is her final rebuke and curse. You but invite your death in my guise. So it's very gentle rebuke, you could say. It's verbal, just by way of comparison. interestingly enough, you know, in the Ramayana, when one's reading this section, Ravana is actually delighted that she may be feeling fearful of him. So he's actually hoping that she's fearful of him. So Srila Prabhupada states in the purport of the next verse that Ravana's wife Mandadari was also chaste or very restrained in the way that Sita was. And in the verse we're reading today, we're hearing Mandadari talking, and she's saying, "Oh my Lord, oh Master," referring to Ravana. So she's one of the wives that Ravana has, you know, cast aside, telling Sita that he's looking at them with disgust. But this is one of those wives, his chief wife, Mandadari. She's referring to Ravana upon seeing his dead body, "Oh Lord, oh Master." So Sita's virtue is also seen in her stating her position to Ravana. So there's a description of, she realized, well, she knows that it's not actually correct to be having a very close conversation with a stranger as a chaste person or a very restrained person, being a woman's body. So she throws a blade of grass. So see the subtlety. A blade of grass serves as the divider between herself and Ravana. She puts down a blade of grass. Because as a faithful wife, it's not proper to speak to so openly to a stranger. So she says, the soul of virtue, and this is again that picture that she's painting of Lord Ramachandra as the ideal husband. The soul of virtue, he's the Lord of myriad worlds, and him do I call my husband. With such noble and stainless connection with a husband who has no peer in all creation, would I stoop to a low and unrighteous act? He and his brother Lakshman have taken birth in the line of Ikshvaku, but to slay you, so I have not the slightest fear of you. Why does he not bestir himself now? Had you but committed this outrage in his presence, you would have taken your place by the side of Karu, a rotting corpse, somebody that got killed. Your rakshasas of matchless strength would tremble at his sight, as serpents tremble at the sight of Garuda. His sharp gold-banded shafts will pierce your vitals as the roaring flood topples down the banks of the Ganges. You have escaped death till now at the hands of gods and asuras, but you will not survive to tell the tale of your enmity to Ram. So again, there's the curse coming there. She's acknowledging, you know, he's escaped death till now, but he's not going to survive to tell this tale of his enmity towards her, to Lord Ramachandra. and this very, this part of her curse where she actually tells Ravana that Lord Ramachandra's gold-banded shaft is actually going to pierce his vitals, it comes to pass because it's Lord Ramachandra's arrow which pierces Ravana's heart. He shoots the one arrow that pierces Ravana's heart like a thunderbolt. It's got so much power and strength behind it. And separate from, you know, looking at how Sita paints the picture of Lord Ramachandra as the ideal husband and her own extraordinary behavior being faced with this in this very, very difficult situation, we also get a sense of how Lord Ramachandra is viewing Sita. So there's also this picture being painted of the ideal wife, and he's actually in a state of grieving over Sita's kidnapping. So he tells Lakshman, so there's one moment where they're walking. So this is how Lord Ramachandra is processing. So Lord Ramachandra says, "My heart takes a fresh wound at every step of mine over these mountains, where maddened birds lose themselves in an ocean of joy. I cannot, I will not be consoled until I behold her again. My life threads threaten to snap unless I share not this pleasant breeze from Pampa with my beloved Sita. Thrice happy are those to whom it is given to enjoy this cool zephyr that blows from the groves that border Pampa, heavy with the fragrance of sweet lotus and lily, and ever busy with its mission of relieving true lovers of their burden of sorrow and fatigue. So, he's truly in a state of grieving. And there's another section where he's calling on Lord Vayu to, touch Lord Sita so that the same breeze can come to him and touch him. So he's truly showing this picture of grieving at the separation. Now, because this verse is dealing with this moment of the loss of a beloved spouse, I thought to look at another section that's dealing with the queen's losing King Dasarath. So this is after Lord Ramachandra and Lakshman and Sita leave for the forest, and we read how those queens respond to the loss of a beloved spouse. So I'm going to read that too. So this is the queens of King Dasarath. They knew very well the usual signs of sleep: light, heavy, and profound, the movement of the limbs, the beating of the heart, and the deep and regular breathing. They observed him variously and minutely, but could discover none of the above signs of life. Mighty fear took hold of them. They trembled at the horrible suspicion that forced itself upon their minds that their Lord had gone forth from their midst, never to return. They shivered and shook like the tender water plants that lie in the path of a roaring torrent. Then the truth was forced upon them that their suspicions were but too true. So again, this moment of separation. There's a reason I'm highlighting these moments of separation connected to this verse, and I'll come to it a little bit further along. Now, one can say, we've heard the internal feelings of Sita towards Lord Ramachandra. We've heard something of his grieving at their separation. And we've heard Ravana presenting himself as such a terror of the worlds. And when he's in front of Sita, he's presenting himself as a simple, renounced personality. But I'm going to read what Ravana actually presents like, who is this personality? And this is the first description, comes in the Ramayana, when Marut, one of the soldiers of Lord Ramachandra's army, actually enters Lanka and he sees Ravana. So this is actually Ravana in terms of physical appearance. A golden crown encrusted with every variety of rare and priceless gems shone on his head, decked with strings of pearls. Ornaments of curious and wonderful pattern, set with rare gems and precious stones, flashed all over his body, as if the creation of the fancy of an artist in his olden hours. Garments of silk, snowy white, covered his limbs. Perfumes and paste of civet, musk, and sandal. Aloes of diverse designs were skillfully painted over his mighty chest and arms. He was gazing intently at Ananjaya, so this is Maruti, the soldier from Ravana's army. And most frightfully, with his rolling eyes, blood red, twice 10 in number, so 20 eyes, he's gazing with 20 eyes. His cruel tusks, so he actually has tusks, gleam through his hanging lips. His 10 heads gave one the idea of the lofty Mandara with its cloud-capped peaks, jaunted by beasts of prey. His complexion resembled that of a hill of black paint. It's very closed and dark, his complexion. It flashed into my mind. Over the years with doing photography, I used to maintain dark rooms because it was manual printing. So one would have to paint a room pitch black in order to be able to do the printing, because no light can enter that room. So I'm imagining Ravana's face being that dark. I mean, in that particular setting, one needed like an infrared light to allow one to see. Anyway, his complexion is so dark, it clearly hides everything. And his broad chest was adorned with a rope of pearls, whose pendant blazed like the moon in its full, even as a dark cloud bank across which lines of cranes take flight. Garlands, necklaces, and armlets lay gracefully over his shoulders and arms, while rare sandal pastes were painted upon them most skillfully. His arms were long, hard, stout, and muscular, and resembled huge serpents of the five-headed variety. So this is the Ravana. there's an interesting contrast that one can see in the view that's held by the Rakshasa wives of their dead husbands, and the other, and that held by Lord Ramachandra, and even by Sita of Lord Ramachandra. So Mandadari, she tells us in the next verse, of course I'm not going to go deeply into it, but just because it gives us some insight, you epitomize trouble for others. She's quite conscious of who Ravana is, her husband, that she's quite chaste to. And therefore, you were called Ravana. She understands the cause of Ravana's difficulty too, and his defeat by Lord Ramachandra. And she says, "O greatly fortunate one, you came under the influence of lusty desire, and therefore you could not understand the influence of Mother Sita." So this is Mandadari, his very chaste wife. She knows precisely what his difficulty is. And now because of her curse, you have been reduced to this state. Having been killed by Lord Ramachandra. And it's interesting, we'll come to it. Srila Prabhupada actually says that women develop a kind of supernatural power because of having very restrained behavior and being loyal and chaste towards their husbands. And you can see it even in Mandadari, who's a man-eater woman. She's the wife of Ravana, but she has the insight and is able to be very cool, calm, and collected in terms of her understanding of where her husband's weakness lies. Anyway, I'm just going to connect it to something in contemporary culture. since I have a brother who's a British subject, I'm sort of more aware of the British royalty. So there's a tremendous amount of negative feelings towards a woman that the Prince of Wales had married much later on in his life. I think the woman must have been closer to 50 since his first wife had died. And the woman had, I should mention by name, this Camilla, yeah. So the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles. So anyway, there's a tremendous amount of negativity about the woman because there was so much loyalty to the first princess. And anyway, so she's painted as a kind of unchaste person, that somehow she'd always maintained a connection with the prince even through his first marriage. And indeed, he makes no secret that he had a mistress. So in the there's always another side to everything. One reads that this woman, the same woman, this woman Camilla, that the prince married much later on in his life and her life, she actually was very loyal to her husband, that was constantly at the mercy of his lusty desires, but never complained, dutifully maintained her home, dutifully brought up her children. And this is, they're public figures. This Camilla. So she's cast in a bad light, but then when you actually read, the woman actually was, very diligent in her duties to her husband. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting, even in the present day, somehow just a woman actually having that kind of chastity puts her in a different light. But anyway, because of the public's loyalty to the first princess, that fact of this woman's life is not seen. So, anyway. Now, there's an So, Srila Prabhupada points to the main moral principle that was not adhered to by Ravana. And that is that one should not be influenced by lusty desires for another's wife. And this is an extremely important principle. And we find, like, even in contemporary culture, like the British monarchy, the prince was questioned, was he loyal to his wife Diana at that time? And he, states quite clearly that yes, he was, until the marriage completely broke down. So anyway, this is an incredibly important principle. One shouldn't be influenced by lusty desires for another man's wife. And this was the particular moral principle that Ravana was constantly breaking. And Sita reveals this to Ravana. She lets him know that he's breaking this moral principle and it's one not to be broken. So she tells Ravana, Ram would scatter the sun and the moon upon the earth if he so minded. He would turn the fathomless oceans into boundless deserts of burning sand. Of course, should he wish to do so. So would he fail to deliver Sita from your impious hands? And the shadow of oblivion is upon your life, wealth, might, and valor. Lanka is helpless, masterless, and widowed all through you. So she lets Ravana know that his action is bringing this about, that the state will become helpless, it will become without a master, and widowed all through you. So his action is of such gravity, this one of having proposing to another man's wife, meaning Sita, We have Mandadari in this verse of today. She's indeed become widowed, and indeed the state is without its master. And she puts it this way: but now that you've been defeated, we are also defeated. For without you, the state of Lanka has been conquered by the enemy. To whom will it go for shelter? So this is the view of Ravana's wife, Chase's wife. So there's a further principle, and that's been highlighted by Mandadari here, and that is that a woman should always be protected. So she's seen herself as now having no shelter. Just by the defeat of Ravana, the state has been defeated. And she's asking, whom is the state going to go for shelter? And the same could be applied to her. So there's that protection by the husband that's necessary and is an important principle that's been highlighted as well. Now, maybe the last important part in this whole narration is this impetus for sinful activity that Ravana had. It's actually explained by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. He says it's lust only which is born of contact with the material world, of passion, and later transformed into wrath, and which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. So it's one's personal enemy, lust. So that was the personal enemy of Ravana. It wasn't Ramachandra, Lord Ramachandra. It was his own lust. That was his real enemy. And and so lust is actually what's responsible for any living entity in this material world for causing that kind of incredible entanglement because it's originating from, there's a natural kind of service attitude, but it's then been channeled into sense enjoyment, and because of this, one comes under the sway of lust. One's completely at the mercy of this enemy, and that was the position of Ravana. So this, I guess, kind of brings to an end what I could think of or understand from this very short purport today. So if there's any thought to expand the discussion.
Thank you for class. You brought out a lot of detail with the pastime, which was nice. I haven't heard too much of the Ramayana, so thank you. I'm wondering kind of we've been talking the last couple of days of how the human-like pastimes of Ramachandra attract us. I'm wondering, I guess, because the story of Lord Ram and Sita is kind of like dramatic, almost like romantic. So I'm wondering how, because it seems like a lot of people you can like get some sentimental enjoyment out of hearing and almost like fantasizing, and then almost like for yourself you want to like have such a romantic experience. That seems like that's like the Ravana tendency, to want to have that, even on just like a smaller scale. Ravana is like the ultimate like personification of that, how it could be at its worst. So I'm wondering how to, if that's common, like a common misunderstanding of hearing the pastimes, and what is the right way to hear, how to get the most out of this, that this pastime of, between Ram and Sita.
It's an interesting, I guess, a point you brought, that one could look at the pastime as highly romantic and sort of aspire to have that sort of romantic element in one's own life on a smaller scale. That could be the response. And so your question is very interesting, of what would be the way to actually look at the pastime. I mean, it's quite fantastic. And I guess, you know, I'm a lot of, I'm sort of intrigued by how the public, let's say in Britain, responded when the Princess of Wales, I guess in the 90s, was killed very prematurely in her life. And there was like an outpouring of grief. It's sort of extraordinary in this present age that like there's these visuals of the palace gates just being like knee deep in bouquets of flowers that people had just brought in tribute to this princess. So that's somebody in the contemporary time. And people were fascinated by all her activities, her charitable work. And they were also had a lot of natural loyalty to her, such that they were most disturbed with her husband's inability to maintain that relationship properly. So if even that is happening in the present age with regular people just observing their monarch, and it's eliciting feelings of loyalty, judgment in terms of a person's acting in a pious or impious manner through their, you know, that whether the husband has been sort of chaste to his wife or not. One understands that reading the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra and Sita, it arouses a similar kind of fascination that there's such perfection, such perfect beings that function with the utmost integrity, that view each other with such pure, I guess, love would be the best word, spiritual love. Of course it is, we understand it's not on a mundane level. So it's so I think the reading of it is it's the effect it has, it's actually arousing one's devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, so one's focus is on seeing the and being moved by the perfect behavior, the pure love of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his consort. And that's the effect that should be there, that one's service attitude is aroused, because that is the antidote to any kind of material lust. And indeed, the pastime does elicit that. I found with even myself, you know, reading the Ramayana yesterday, thinking about this verse, I couldn't tear myself away. It is so exquisite, and it moves one and arouses all one's finest sentiments. So it doesn't even enter into the picture, that idea of how could I have a similar sort of thing on my sort of small level. It doesn't come, because it touches the soul. It's and so it elicits more a service attitude, just like those people in Great Britain. It elicited their service attitude, the many bouquets knee deep in front of the palace walls on the death of a princess. It's a similar thing. There's having the greatest examples arouses that desire to not emulate, but rather serve, because one acknowledges the greatness of those personalities. So that's how I understand it, if that helps.
Hare Krishna, Mataji, thank you for your class. You made some wonderful points. Since you brought it up, I'd just like to take the moment to appreciate Princess Diana, because I remember something from my childhood. I wouldn't call her a celebrity, but she was always on TV. And I remember that there, hasn't happened to me before, but when I was a kid, I'm probably around 11, I think she left her body, or, you know, accident in 97, something like that. And I remember, I didn't know why, but I was literally, there was been no celebrity, or I wouldn't consider a celebrity, but I cried, like, literally weep, and I was, like, depressed for a while when she left her body. I didn't know why. Years later, I kind of understood, because, she literally cared about people. It's not like she gave her money in a charitable organization. I would never forget this when I was younger. She would go to war-torn countries, and she would literally personally remove landmines from war-torn countries that people would leave. And a lot of times people didn't know where they were and they would die. And she would literally personally scan fields and remove them. So it wasn't like she just gave her money and say, I'm charitable. She literally risked her life. And that's one just memory. But my question or comment and question is related to the point you were mentioning where Mandudari, Ravana's wife, she said, although in this verse she called him Lord, but later on you were quoting from the Ramayana and she actually called him slave. She said, actually, you're a slave of lust. So although you consider yourself Lord, I call you Lord, probably, you know, so you won't get inflamed, but you're a slave of lust. And I really appreciate that, because there's many pastimes. Like one pastime in Christian book, there's a devotee named Muchukunda. I forgot what the chapter is called, but his name Muchukunda is mentioned in it. And in that pastime, if you look up Muchukunda in Christian book, you'll see the chapter with his name. And in that pastime, the demigods recruited him because he was a great fighter against the demons. They said, please come help us fight the demons. And after he defeated the demons for many years, he actually had a realization. He spoke some prayers to the Lord. He said, actually, although the demigods consider me a great king, a great warrior, a great controller, actually, when I go home, I'm actually the slave of women, the slave of lust. So I'm actually not a king, a controller, I'm a slave. So my question is related to that point, is that you were mentioning one should not lust after one's wife, or generally lust after anyone, because that's, you know, that's going to be some karmic reactions, some repercussions. But we hear in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 14, especially Prabhupada purport, he says that one cannot be released from these most material nature unless somebody releases him. He uses the example that we're tied down like ropes. The most ties down, unless somebody liberated, comes release you. So my question is that how does one not get discouraged when they think, oh, let me not lust after somebody's wife? But it's not that easy. We're not in control. And in Srimad Bhagavatam 1:2:17, Krishna says, I'm the only person who can release you from these most material nature, but try your best. Come to Bhagavatam, hear Bhagavatam, and try your best. So a lot of times we get discouraged when we think we're in control. Yes, it's that easy. Let me not think about somebody's wife, lust after them. So can you explain, can you elaborate on that point of how to not discourage? And I didn't formulate my question properly, but maybe you could give some enlightening points on that subject matter, especially not getting discouraged.
Yeah, it's an interesting question that if somebody is in that position of, you know, being caught in a state of lust or being under the sway of lust, particularly in relation to another man's wife, let's say if it's a male personality. And your question is, obviously, it may not be such a simple thing to move away from that, particularly because one is so heavily under the influence of the modes of material nature, and I'm adding particularly the mode of passion in that case, because that's what Krishna's, Lord Krishna's explanation is, that coming under the sway of lust is due to the mode of passion. So it's a taken that indeed one is bound. And in fact, Krishna says that that's what leads to all further material entanglements. So yeah, you're quite correct in saying that it seems to be a difficult thing to surpass. So the question you raised was, you know, how does one surpass that? And in one sense, you gave an indication yourself by saying that you'd understood that it requires somebody to come along and release one from the terrible ropes that one's been bound with through the modes of material nature. So, yeah, the development of finer sentiments, such as, you know, complete fidelity to one's spouse, or being able to see another man's wife as a motherly figure versus an object of lust, or an object for the satisfaction of one's lust, is something that requires taking up a process that allows one to develop those kind of cultural outlooks that put another man's wife into the non-touchable category. So, I mean, Vedic culture in particular is... I mean, there's the aspect of one's wishing to perform all activities in service to the Supreme Lord. So just by virtue of having that as the underpinning basis for one's activities, it gives one the strength and the forbearance to stay on a moral path, you could say. I mean, immorality doesn't enter the picture, because one's whole underpinning for one's activities are on a much higher level. So it's naturally cultivation. If one has come to some point of conflict, internal conflict, where there's, you know, on a basic moral level, it would be a wrong course of action to give way to feelings of lust. one has to remind oneself what the purpose is for all one's actions. So the purpose for all one's actions is to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it naturally means that all actions fall onto the within the bounds of proper morality, just by having that as the underpinning basis for one's life and one's actions. So it's not the kind of struggle that a regular person would have who is not who doesn't have that underpinning basis for their life. A regular person who's not acknowledging the the necessity to live one's life in service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is going to naturally be completely at the mercy of the most material nature. There's no hope. So, but in the case of one who has that underpinning of wishing to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is protected. One senses those thoughts, or one senses those any kind of learned behavior from the past that may be trying to impel one in an immoral direction. One senses that, and there's some ease to be able to do that just by virtue of one's service to the Supreme Personality of God. It is not such a struggle as it may appear. That's my thought. Because there's always the protection. So it's like, you know, you hear Sita's talking. She's in a very dire situation. And she's, even though she's somewhat fearful of this aggressive, it's an aggressor who's come into her path, she can actually state that she knows she's under the shadow of protection of Ram's mighty bow. She's quite clear about that. And she can actually even openly make a comparison and call him a sinful wretch. And she can actually feel that wrath and contempt quite easily, because she knows she's protected. If one is not feeling protected, then one would not be able to be so clear in one's understanding. So yes, I believe it's not such a struggle as it might appear. Yeah. So thank you very much. Thank you. All glories to Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.